assist you in arranging for a pickup. We'll tow it away and we'll mail you all the necessary paperwork for you to write it off of your taxes. Call us now at 877-KPFK-AUTO or donate online at kpfk.org by clicking Pledge Support.
To engage in any activity
that shall contribute
to a lasting understanding
between nations and between the individuals of all nations,
races, creeds, and colors.
To gather and disseminate information
on the causes of conflict
between any and all of such groups,
and through any and all means
compatible with the purposes of this corporation,
to promote the study of political and economic problems
and of the causes of religious, philosophical,
and racial antagonisms.
That is our mission.
Hi, this is Lila Downs. You're listening to KPFK 90.7 FM Los Angeles, 98.7 FM Santa Barbara, globally on kpfk.org.
Si porque te quiero, quieres llorona que yo.
Welcome to Sojourner Truth. I'm Thandisizwe Chimaringa, sitting in for Nana Jamfi. We live in a global world. We are all interrelated. So on Sojourner Truth, we work to bring directly to you news and views on local, national, and international policies and stories that affect us all. And we draw out how those of us most impacted, women, communities of color, and other communities, are responding. We also discuss the relationship between art and politics. And now, the news headlines.
For Pacifica, I'm Sharon Sabota. A U.S. airstrike that targeted an alleged Islamic State camp in Nigeria has caused panic in the village of Jabo. On Thursday, residents witnessed the sky glowing red from the attack. U.S. President Donald Trump announced the strike, which was confirmed as a joint effort with Nigeria. Villagers who had never experienced a major terror attack were confused and scared. The Nigerian government has not disclosed details about the militants targeted. Analysts suggest the strike may have been aimed at the Lakura group, a new threat in the region. Locals say they are anxious and afraid of further attacks. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky says that he will meet on Sunday with U.S. President Donald Trump in Florida. Zelensky told journalists that the two leaders will discuss security guarantees for Ukraine during Sunday's talks and that the 20-point plan under discussion is about, quote, 90% ready. A Russian court has sentenced pro-war activist Sergei Udaltsov to 6 years in prison for justifying terrorism. Udaltsov, a known critic of President Vladimir Putin, was arrested last year. The charges relate to an article he posted supporting activists accused of forming a terrorist organization. Those activists received prison sentences earlier this month. Udaltsov, who has rejected the charges as fabricated, announced a hunger strike after the verdict. One-time Jeffrey Epstein girlfriend Ghislaine Maxwell is back in the spotlight with public release of investigative records that led to her 2021 sex trafficking conviction. Among items unsealed are the grand jury transcripts of testimony that led to her indictment. She's serving a 20-year prison sentence. She was moved to a minimum security camp in Texas earlier this year, soon after she submitted to 2 days of questioning by Deputy Attorney General Todd Blanche. 2 years ago, she asked a federal judge to free her, claiming she was unjustly convicted. The public release of investigation materials brings fresh light to the evidence against her. Meanwhile, lawmakers on both sides of the political aisle say they're unsatisfied with the DOJ's pace and process for releasing the files. KPFA's Jacques Lager-Montel has more.
The DOJ has faced criticism for only releasing a tiny portion of the files it has on Epstein and for its heavy and haphazard redactions, despite the Epstein File Transparencies Act mandate that all files be released with minimal reductions by December 19th. In a statement issued December 22nd, Representative Khanna and Kentucky Republican Congressman Thomas Massey, the co-authors of the Transparency Act, said they are bringing inherent contempt charges against Attorney General Pam Bondi.
And I think the most expeditious way to get justice for these victims is to bring inherent contempt against Pam Bondi. And that doesn't require going through the courts. And basically, Ro Khanna and I are talking about and drafting that right now.
Representative Khanna said that DOJ's failure to comply with the Epstein Files Transparency Act constituted an obstruction of justice. The charges could result in a $5,000 a day fine for Bondi after a 30-day grace period. For KPFA, I'm Jacques Labarger-Martel.
Some 100 federal immigration lawyers have been fired by the Trump administration in cities across the country. Edwin J. Vivera has more.
Eileen Grench, an immigration enforcement reporter with Documented, says recently fired San Francisco immigration judge Jeremiah Johnson sees this as an attack on the courts.
He noted that he himself had taken on an extra load of cases in addition to his normal caseload for those who were outside of those detention centers in everyday life. He said he felt this was kind of a broader strategy to reshape this U.S. legal system into a tool for mass deportation.
There hasn't been an explanation for the firings from the Executive Office of Immigration Review. They've only said they don't comment on personnel matters. After the firings, the Trump administration has begun to install judges more likely to rule in favor of deportation in New York, San Francisco, Boston, and Santa Ana. Grench says the fired judges feel this is the administration's way of skirting the law when it comes to justice for all immigrants. I'm Edwin J. Vieira. This story was produced with original reporting by Eileen Grench for Documented.
Equality California, the nation's largest statewide LGBTQ plus civil rights organization, released a statement in response to a federal court ruling in the Mirovalli versus Olson case, which blocked enforcement of multiple California laws that protect transgender and gender nonconforming students from being outed at school and allowing educators to respect a student's name and pronouns. In the statement, Equality California's executive director, Tony Hong, asked for an appeal. He's saying California's student protections recognize the importance of family involvement while also acknowledging that forcing a student to come out before they're ready can cause harm. They called Judge Benitez's ruling dangerous and said it undermines California's Safety Act, which was meant to keep students and schools safe for all kids. For Pacifica, I'm Sharon Sabota.
Those were the news headlines from Pacifica Radio. You're listening to Sojourner Truth. I'm Tonda Sizwe-Shimaringa, sitting in for Nana Jamfi. As of this past Monday, the United Nations has warned that the war in Sudan is entering a deadlier phase as intensified fighting in the Kordofan region, mounting civilian casualties from drone strikes, and growing risks of regional spillover pushed the conflict toward the 1,000-day mark. Briefing the Security Council on Monday, senior UN political and humanitarian officials described a sharply deteriorating security and humanitarian situation marked by indiscriminate attacks, expanding territorial gains by the rapid support forces, and escalating dangers for civilians, aid workers, and peacekeepers. Sudan has been ravaged by civil war since April of 2023, when a power struggle between the military and the militia known as the Rapid Support Forces, or RSF, exploded into open warfare. On the second anniversary of the start of the conflict, more than 13 million people had been displaced, and half of the 51 million population needed food aid. Sudan is currently the largest displacement crisis in the world. Our guest today, to untangle some of this, is Ibrahim Alduma, an international development practitioner and researcher whose work focuses on civic engagement, governance reform, and peace building in conflict-affected societies. His experience includes organizing and building the capacity of Sudan's neighborhood resistance committees, leading large-scale civic education programs, and documenting human rights violations during periods of political unrest. He has also contributed to policy advocacy and research on civil society representation and post-conflict reconstruction. His current work examines how grassroots movements can drive peace and democratic transition and accountability in fragile states such as Sudan. Ibrahim, thank you for being on Sojourner Truth today.
Thank you so much for having me here.
You sound like the perfect person to help us untangle this. So please, other than what the United Nations and the news are reporting, tell us what is happening in Sudan. But more importantly, can you tell us why it's happening?
Yeah, thank you so much for having me here again. And thank you for spreading the word about Sudan to the people of the United States here. They are very powerful. And I really appreciate, before starting, the contribution and the solidarity of the United States people in advocating for Sudan, despite what's going on there. Beside what you have said about me, as a person from Darfur, and especially from Al-Fashir, the recent city have witnessed the most severe genocide that happened in Darfur by RSF 1.5 months ago. And a person who came lately from Sudan after the war broke out, as a Sudanese person, I will like take this opportunity to tell people about what's going on in Sudan, which started since the coup of the military coup of both RSF and SAF in October 2021. And then when they started this war in April 15th, 2023, which is 2.5 months ago, it was just overpowered. But this happened mainly the one cause about this is the power. But there are a lot of layers of deep in conflict between civilians and military forces in Sudan, which expanded for decades. And there's the problem of militarizing the tribes in Sudan and feeding the ethnic conflicts between Arab and non-Arab tribes, which he, that illustrated by RSF, they were armed by al-Bashir, but they were intensified and they're increased during the military coup since 2021 until 2023. They increased from over 50,000 troops until 120,000 troops. And then they started, they have tried to swallow the whole country and making a coup against the military, but the military stopped that. And then they continued doing genocide against civilians instead of continuing fighting with the military, while the military was just protecting their headquarters and stopped protecting civilians. That's why you said that now in Sudan, we are witnessing the highest volume of displaced people and even killed people, and the largest humanitarian crisis in the world.
Yes, that was a lot. That was a lot. I'm going to ask you to slow down just a little bit so we can digest all of that. Now, I have a question about the RSF, and I'm going to come back to, I have a lot of questions, but let me start with this. Trying to get an understanding of what it is the RSF says it wants politically to the world. What is that political phrase, or do they even have one?
Well, this is a great question, and it's very difficult to answer this in an abstractive way, but I will try my best to do this. RSF is mainly Arab tribes. They are mainly herders in Darfur, and Darfur is one of the largest regions of Sudan, which is the Western Sudan, continues hundreds of thousands of tribes between Arabs and non-Arab tribes. So the non-Arab tribes are mainly farmers, while the Arab tribes are herders. They had some conflicts over the land between them in the previous decades, maybe 3 or 4 decades. When the non-Arab tribes started their movements against the central government because of the inequality in distributing resources in Sudan, al-Bashir started feeding these Arab tribes and weaponing them to fight on behalf of the armed, of the Sudanese armed forces, here when the conflict started in Sudan, instead of being between the center and the western Sudan, it became ethnic and tribal war between Sudanese and Western Sudanese, Arab and non-Arab Western Sudanese. That was started by the previous regime, which is Omar al-Bashir. He created this leader of RSF, Hemeti, and he weaponized him. He fed him with the resources that so who could fight at that time. Then, when the al-Bashir removed during the revolution of 2019, the second leader of the armed forces invited Hemeti from suburbs of Sudan, from the Western Sudan, after committing a lot of genocides during the war in Darfur and in Kordofan, from 2003 to 2007, and again after from 2014 to 2017. After that, and with the full immunity, they invited him to come to Khartoum, at the capital of Sudan, just to protect al-Bashir before he got removal. After he got removal, the second leader invited him to be the deputy president of the Sovereignty Council of Sudan. And then he started increasing his volumes and building international relations with Russia, with UAE, and smuggling gold and sometimes with the European Union to protect from the human trafficking. And then he increased, just expanded as an exclusion in Sudan. So he doesn't have any political project. He just he created his own forces by himself. And when he increased enough to be almost equivalent to the armed forces, the leader of RSF sort of making coup and ruling the country, taking the power.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Now, prior to this conflict, South Sudan had, quote unquote, seceded, had it not? So there was a civil war in Sudan, there was a secession, and we had the country of South Sudan, did we not?
Yes, yes.
Now, how is that factoring, or is it not factoring into the...
It was always about the distribution of resources between the center of Sudan and the suburb of Sudan. The mm-hmm. central government was not qualified enough to rule the whole country and to divide the resources and building the infrastructure and other rights like the health structure and the education structure of the different areas of Sudan. That's why we had armed movement against the center from South Sudan, which ended with separation of the whole country. Which mm-hmm. is north of South Sudan now, and that the same cause of the armed conflict and armed movement against the center from the Western Sudan, which was RSF created to fight them and to avoid mm-hmm. the conflict from the center. The armed movement from Darfur were aiming to come to the center of Sudan, which is Khartoum, so al-Bashir created Hemeti to step them there. And that's why it's just like a balance of tribal conflict fed by the center government.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I'm speaking with Ibrahim Al-Duma, international development practitioner and researcher, trying to make sense for our audience of what is happening in Sudan, which is currently the world's largest displacement crisis. April of 2023 is when this current conflict begins. October of 2023 is when the war in Gaza takes place, leading to that crisis and this current phase of the crisis and the genocide in Palestine and Gaza. Thanks to Al Jazeera correspondents in particular, the world has been able to see on the ground what has been happening in Gaza and Palestine. That's also why the State of Israel has made it its business to murder journalists in Gaza and Palestine. We had not been seeing that much information out of Sudan until recently, with the information regarding the genocide and the murders conducted in, I believe it was Al-Fashir, the location of the most recent mm-hmm. genocides. Is Al-Fashir?
Yes, Al-Fashir, yeah.
Al-Fashir, yes. But the words and the videos and the messaging was not coming from reporters, either from Al Jazeera or on the ground. It was coming from the RSF fighters themselves. showing the depravity, showing the brutality. Is there any type of infrastructure that regular people, the populace, has access to help tell the story of what's happening in Sudan?
Yeah, thank you so much for this question. And it's not only the international media, but also the high level and the first level of the governments in different countries and states, including the United States. We had a lot of advocacy campaigns around the Congress, in the American Congress. Most of the representatives and the senators are not fully aware of what's going on in Sudan. I know the competing agenda of the world, like the war in Gaza, the war in Ukraine, and the other things made people just not taking care of what's going on in Sudan. And they're just like defining that as civil war. And this war is not civil war. They're just saying that civil war and people killing each other, and there's no government and these things, which is very frustrating for those people. But thank you so much for giving me this opportunity to elaborate more. People didn't take care because they are very difficult. Journalists work in Sudan at that time, especially in the RSF territory, as they are not organized and they are killing people and journalists brutally. And because of the impunity that have been continuing in Sudan since 2003, which no one of these perpetrators of the first genocide have been held accountable, all of these were just making sarcasms on the International Criminal Court and the other justice entities. They're saying that whoever wants us, he can just come to find us here. So it's very difficult for people, and especially for journalists, to work in an environment where they don't have any rights, even the rights to stay alive, or the rights to take pictures, or the internet connection, and different difficulties face the journalists. But the RSF themselves have documented all of these things in challenging to all of the world and challenging to the international justice entities.
Understanding that it is very challenging, understanding its horrendous and difficult circumstances, can you share with our audience any sources for up-to-date coverage, information on what is happening on the ground in Sudan?
Yeah, thank you so much for asking this. We have a lot of pages, especially in X. We have something called Sudan War Monitor. Sudan War Monitor is very reliable and professional journalist site, so that they are like covering all the having incidents in Sudan now, ongoing covering for the incidents in Sudan. And we have other, the same Sudan War Monitor, we have it in X and we have it in Facebook as well. And there are some other entities that are working on this, like the Amnesty International, they are working on this, and sometimes Sudan Human Rights Watch and Sudan Human Rights Hub. These are the three you can find some reliable information and updated information about what's going on in Sudan.
Okay, Amnesty International. And yes. What were the other two?
The international organization Amnesty, they are making reports, maybe regular reports, sometimes weekly reports, sometimes monthly reports, and sometimes incident reports about what's going on there.
Right. That's Amnesty International, but you named two other organizations.
Yeah. Sudan War Monitor.
Sudan War Monitor.
Yes. And Sudan X. Conflict. Yes. And X, yeah. This is okay, very reliable content.
Okay. I'm sorry. Sudan War Monitor. And what is the other one?
Sudan Conflict Update.
Okay. Sudan Conflict Update.
Yes.
Sudan War Monitor. Amnesty International. And
yes,
these should be available on social media such as X, Facebook, Instagram, etc.
And they have their own website as well.
Okay, but in addition to their own websites, where people can look those up.
Sure, and the Guardian, the Guardian journal is very good in covering Sudan updates as well.
Okay, that would be the fourth one. The Guardian out of England, also providing coverage.
Regular
coverage. To the extent that they can.
Yes.
All right. So for our audience members who want more information on the work that you're doing, Ibrahim Alduma, how can they get that?
If they want more details about what's going on in Sudan, there are some updates, and there are some advocacy ad hoc in the United States. There is an organization called Sudan Action Hub. They have a website. Also, you can write it. So you can just reach out to them, sudanactionhub.org, or my personal email. I'm more than happy to help whoever wants any information, updates, policy papers, policy research, the updates of the advocacy in the Congress, or any kind of these activities. We have like different civil society organizations in the United States working together. We have some scholars from different universities and some Sudanese advocates as well. So I will put my personal email here for anybody could reach out to me, or just write Sudan Action Hub. You can find them in the website and reach contact us. You can just contact them.
Sudan Action Hub.
Yes. This is an organization registered in the United States working on fundraising for the humanitarian aid in Sudan and working on advocacy and different researches and organizing with local entities here.
Ibrahim Alduma, international development practitioner and researcher whose experience includes organizing and building the capacity of Sudan's neighborhood resistance committees. Thank you so much for being on Sojourner Truth today.
Thank you so much for having me, and thank you for spreading the word about Sudan.
Absolutely. The deadline for enrolling in a marketplace plan through the Affordable Care Act for 2026 came and went without an agreement on the federal subsidies that kept ACA plans more affordable for many Americans. Despite a last-ditch attempt in the House to extend ACA subsidies, with Congress adjourning for the year on December 19th, it's looking almost certain that Americans relying on ACA subsidies will face a steep increase in healthcare costs in 2026. So writes TheConversation.com on December 15th. According to NBC, as of 2 days ago, some Americans may finally catch a break on rising costs as the first negotiated Medicare drug prices go into effect. Others will end up paying more as ACA tax credits expire and Medicaid coverage becomes more uncertain amid drastic cuts in state funding. What exactly is going on? Here to discuss that with me now is Jamila Mishner, Associate Professor of Government and Public Policy, the inaugural director of the Center for Racial Justice and Equitable Futures, Senior Associate, Dean of Public Engagement, the Brooks School of Public Policy at Cornell University. Thank you for being on Sojourner Truth today.
Thank you for having me. I'm so glad to be having this important conversation.
Well, I'm so glad that you're so glad, because I have no idea what's happening other than somebody's going to pay some money and somebody not. So please help me help our audience understand.
Yeah, I appreciate that honesty, and honest and it reflects the way probably most people feel, because this is an extension of an enduring set of battles, really, both policy battles and political battles over, you know, whether healthcare is truly a right, and if it is, how we ensure that people can have access to it, especially in a system that treats healthcare as a commodity. And in a system where healthcare is a commodity, somebody has to pay for it. And the question at the heart of all of this is who should pay for it. And a big part of what the Affordable Care Act, as some people call Obamacare, a big part of what that did was say, the government is going to take a significant responsibility for making sure that everybody can have access to healthcare, regardless of their income. Now, Obamacare isn't perfect, and it didn't actually ensure universal coverage. It didn't offer everybody health insurance, but it came really close, and it came close through two major levers. One was expanding the number of people who could have access to Medicaid, which is mostly health insurance for low-income people and people with disabilities in the U.S. And another was providing people who are in the next level up, middle income, lower middle income, with the subsidies. And the subsidies allow them to actually pay for health insurance on health insurance marketplaces themselves. So you either could get it directly from the government through Medicaid, if you were low income, and if you were middle income but couldn't afford the astronomical price of healthcare, you could get these subsidies. Now, under the kind of current administration, both Medicaid and the subsidies in different ways are under attack. And so a lot of people are going to be facing a situation where they simply cannot afford to have access to health insurance. And we're back at the same dilemma. Is healthcare a human right? Is it something that everyone should have access to? And if so, how does the government ensure that that happens? And the current administration is not taking steps to ensure that at all. In fact, we're moving backward in that domain.
It almost seems as if the thinking, and you know, who am I, right? I could be wrong, but it almost kind of sort of seems like healthcare is a human right if you can afford it. If you can't afford it, then you just out, as we say.
Yeah. And at the basis of that is really the implication that in the United States, it isn't a human right. And there are many places where access to healthcare is not as tethered to how much income you have, how much money you have, whether you have an employer that's able to cover your healthcare. So we have made the choice in this country, and we've been making it for a very long time, that your access to healthcare is going to be connected to your economic status, either your employment, your income, your wealth. And that choice means that people get to profit from healthcare, but it also means people at the top, right? Economic elites, they get to profit. There are billions and billions of dollars of profit at stake in our healthcare system. But it also means that a lot of other people in the middle and at the bottom, proverbially, of the economic hierarchy just don't get access.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a choice. We've made that choice again and again, and we continue to make it.
So although we are at the end of December, technically speaking, Donald Trump has not been in office 1 year. He's wreaked a lot of havoc, but it has not been 1 year just yet. What's currently going on with healthcare in this country, the ACA, Medicare, Medicaid, et cetera, how much, if you know, if you can share with the audience, how much of this is following the Project 2025 playbook?
Yeah, well, I will say a lot of it is. A big part of that playbook was to dismantle as much as possible the Affordable Care Act, right? So Obamacare, as some of the people who don't like that policy pejoratively call it, and others who do like it call it that as well. But a lot of the kind of focus in the realm of healthcare with respect to Project 2025 and folks on the right in general is to erode Obamacare, the signature healthcare policy of former President Barack Obama, for a number of different reasons. One thing that's really important to keep in mind is that, you know, healthcare has always been what I call as a scholar, racialized in the U.S., meaning who gets access to healthcare has always looked very different depending on where you stand in the racial hierarchy in this country. And we could go as far back as pre-colonial or colonial times, when people who were enslaved when people who were indigenous, people who were not considered a part of the kind of mainstream racially and who are at the lower end of racial hierarchies, people who were immigrants, who immigrated from other parts of the world, Black and brown folks, they were completely excluded from access for many, many years, right? And even once those communities of people were officially, explicitly given access to healthcare, you know, when they were no longer on paper segregated or excluded, income has always been a way, income and wealth have continued to be ways in our profit-based system of keeping people out, and disproportionately people who are not white in this country, and also white people who are lower income or middle income. But there is a kind of racialized element to our healthcare system, and there always has been. But what survey and other research shows is that that widened in an enormous way during the Obama administration, because Obama became associated with healthcare, and Obama was our, you know, thought of and understood to be the first Black president, and people started to have opinions on healthcare at that point that were more divided by race than we had seen really at any point previously, and a big part of what became the platform of many of the opponents of Obama was taking down that kind of healthcare legacy that he had built up through the Affordable Care Act for all its imperfections, right? Because the Affordable Care Act did not change what is the most fundamental, I would say the most fundamental problem with our healthcare system, which is that it treats healthcare as a commodity and it is a profit-based system. The Obamacare didn't change that, but it mitigated some of that. But who did it and how it was done and the ways that it started to mitigate and address the deep racial inequalities in our healthcare system, there were huge pushbacks against that. And we see that reflected in Project 2025. These subsidies, their initial kind of, you know, emergence was through Obamacare, the expansion of Medicaid that happened through Obamacare. A lot of the program that we see right now is about pushing back on those things. And that predated the current Trump administration. It's been a long running fight. But now they have the power to really advance some of these prerogatives in a way that they hadn't before. And so it's absolutely part of that larger scheme that is part and parcel of Project 2025, but really goes deeper than it.
I'm speaking with Jamila Mishner, Associate Professor of Government and Public Policy at Cornell University. I want to come back to this, but we're going to take a quick break.
Yes.
And once we come back, I want to get more into this with you. You're listening to Sojourner Truth here on KPFK, 90.7 FM in Los Angeles. I'm Tondesi Shimoringa, sitting in for Nana Jomfe.
Support for KPFK comes in part from Rhythm Tribe, in concert, live at Catalina Jazz Club. Sunday, January 4th, 2026, Rhythm Tribe blends Hibato rhythms like bomba with Afrobeat and R&B to create a unique neo-soul Latin fusion sound. Further information and tickets are available at catalinajazzclub.com and dancemaster.com.
Thank you for listening to 90.7 FM in Los Angeles, 98.7 FM in Santa Barbara, 93.7 FM in San Diego, 99.5 FM in Ridgecrest and China Lake, and around the globe at kpfk.org.
This is Sojourner Truth here on KPFK. My name is Tandesizwe Shimaringa, and I'm sitting in for Nana Jamfi. I'm speaking with Jamila Mishner, Associate Professor of Government and Public Policy at Cornell University. And we're talking about healthcare and what's coming down the pipe in 2026. We just talked about basically what was the Obama backlash to the Affordable Care Act. You talked about the fundamental problem of healthcare in the US, that it is treated as a commodity and a profit-based system. Of course, under a capitalist system, it would be done that way. And you've also talked about some of the history in terms of healthcare and people who have been racialized, or should I say, how healthcare has been racialized, how it has affected Black and Brown people. But because healthcare is treated as a commodity, and we're talking about a profit-based system, who is most vulnerable to losing coverage if these subsidies aren't extended? And what I mean by that is, across the board, is it mostly low-income workers? Is it middle-class families? Is it both?
Yeah, I love this question because I think that people can sometimes assume that only the most marginalized, lowest income people who are living, you know, in the most sort of deprivation are going to be affected. But the scope of what's happening here is really important. And especially when it comes to the subsidies, the point of the subsidies was to target the kind of vulnerable lower middle and middle income Americans who aren't living in deep poverty, but who are not going to be able to afford the astronomical costs of healthcare without some kind of subsidization. And the motivation for these ACA, subsidies was that we have a program like Medicaid that is providing for the very low income. And so we need to make sure that the sort of next level up are also being attended to. And so between Medicaid and the subsidies, we're talking about a really large swath of people, both low income and middle income. And of course, that group is disproportionately working class and disproportionately people of color. But it also entails many white people and many people who are up kind of professional class, white collar, and so forth. And so you start to get to the point with these systems where, yes, the harm is disproportionate by class and it's racialized, but also hardly anyone is winning here, except for the wealthiest elites, who, of course, are able to continue to profit from this system.
So that was a December 15th enrollment deadline, and there was no subsidy deal. Congress is out of here enjoying themselves on vacation. Does that lock people into higher costs no matter what Congress does next?
There's some room for maneuver. Some of this will depend on what state you live in and what steps states have taken to try to kind of adjust in response to these dynamics. Some states have been really nimble about trying to create their own pathways for adjusting deadlines and such, others not so much. And of course, there are always legislative pathways for trying to create flexibilities around these deadlines. But it is challenging. It is challenging because if you think about the way that our healthcare systems work, insurance subsidies and so forth, it's like a huge ocean liner and it's moving in a particular direction, and all the inertia of legislation, of policy, of regulations is pushing it in that direction per the deadlines as they've been established. And if you try to turn that huge ocean liner around on a dime, it's going to be hard to do. And so we have allowed these deadlines to pass, knowing that they were coming, knowing that they're hard to turn around quickly, knowing that people were going to be directly affected. And so the costs are already rising. The companies have already accounted for that. And even if, you know, next week Congress were to say, okay, we're getting our act together, it would take some time and it would incur some costs for a substantial subset of people before this could be, this ship could be righted, right? So that we allowed these windows of opportunity to pass. And there's very few upsides for the average person who's being affected by this. The only, you know, positive really, as I see it, is that I hope this is a moment where people's eyes can be open and a moment that creates opportunities for mobilization and organization so that people can begin to pull together in ways that, and exert their power in ways that make these kinds of things less and less possible. For your access to insurance to essentially be held hostage to political machinations and maneuvering that has nothing to do with your well-being is unacceptable. And this is a moment I hope people see that. But harm is going to be almost impossible to avoid here.
I'm glad you mentioned, not the harm part, but I'm glad you mentioned prior to that. I want to ask you about that, but real quick, let me just throw this in here. We've heard estimates of millions of people becoming uninsured. How realistic do you believe those projections are? And what happens to people who drop coverage?
I think those projections are quite realistic. If we think about the subsidies alone, there are roughly 22 million Americans who rely on them. Now, not all 22 million are going to become uninsured, of course, and it's a bit difficult to predict, you know, with complete precision. But when we think about the extent of the increase for people, many people, 40% of Americans can't afford, you know, an emergency expense of more than $400, right? And that's one time. And here we are talking about tens of millions of people who monthly will have an additional $300, $500, $1,500 and upward expense a month in order to maintain their health insurance. Very many people, certainly in the millions, will not be able to afford that. And the people who are closest to the brink financially, even if you're middle class, you know, that doesn't mean that you can spend $700 extra dollars a month than what you were doing before. And for some of the people who become uninsured, there really are very few paths to finding insurance, especially when we're also on the sort of lower end of the market with respect to Medicaid, in terms of the lower income, you know, access to insurance for people with lower income, that's also being pulled back, and there's retrenchment in that space as well. So there are very few places for people to go, and they end up relying on emergency room care. They end up relying on, you know, going into debt, medical debt, which we, you know, has been, there's been movements to try to address medical debt, and this really creates a circumstance where we're going to potentially see more of it. And so there's no easy answers. It's not like, oh, if you really try, you can find a way to get insurance. That's not how it works. It's incredibly expensive and difficult to get through any other systems besides these.
Something you mentioned earlier. I know for me, because I'm constantly monitoring media, social media, popular culture, the image I have of policy is, you know, researching, writing up bills, getting them passed in the legislature, policy implemented at various levels, you know, bureaucracy, in other words. Mm-hmm. But you talked about organizing and fighting back. I think this sounds like one of those instances where people need to be in the streets, angry and refusing to leave the streets until something concrete is done. As a professor of public policy, do you have any suggestions for grassroots organizing and fighting back on this issue?
Absolutely. And I'm so glad that you gave us this image of policy as a thing that is bureaucratic. And one of the things that I tell people, and I tell them this,
bureaucratic and sometimes, maybe not sometimes, very passive.
Yes. One of the things that I tell people, and I say this as someone who studies policy, but also, and perhaps more importantly, as somebody who studies power and who studies how policy both affects the power of people who are economically and racially marginalized, but also how those folks can affect policy. And one of the things that I say is policy is downstream from power. It is a function of power. And a lot of times the reasons that it's, it appears to be passive and bureaucratic and formalized and far away from anything that ordinary people can affect is because the folks who are in power, the elites who are in power, would they think about policy that way. And it serves their interest for us all to think about policy that way. Like, sure, this isn't great. A lot of people losing their health insurance, but what can we do? But the reality is there are things that we can do, and there are levers in our political system for people to affect the policies that most affect them. But those levers are not easily accessed. One of the core levers that ordinary people have access to is what I call people power, the power of numbers, but not if they're disorganized, only if they're organized and mobilized towards really specific ends. And so you mentioned people being out in the street, and that is one way to mobilize power, to make it clear that the status quo is unacceptable and to push the people who are in a position to do so to change the status quo. Frederick Douglass said, you know, power concedes nothing without demand. It never it never will. And so creating the demand, and that demand can be created in the streets. It can be created through organized action that targets legislative, you know, legislators and policy officials. It can be created through media, communication, and messaging that it bubbles up from the ground up. There are numerous different kind of grassroots and people power-based mechanisms for making it clear that the status quo when it comes to healthcare is unacceptable and pushing the people who have the ability to change something to change it. And if they still don't, removing those people from their positions of power and replacing them with people who can and will actually do something. And, you know, sometimes we think of that as happening primarily through electoral channels, and that is one part. Right. But in between elections, there's a ton more that ordinary people can do to create change. They can join organizations, they can mobilize with one another. And I guess one thing I would say is this divide between the kind of middle class who we think is going to be affected right now by these subsidies and the kind of lower income people who are going to be affected by the Medicaid cuts. Part of what we've done is divide those folks so that they don't see their interest as linked. And what's happening now is that we're getting to see really clearly those interests are linked. And so if we can really mobilize across class, across race, and organize people together in strategic ways to kind of target and push back against the folks who are the holdouts here, not only will we potentially be able to fix the problem around subsidies and the Medicaid cuts, but lay the groundwork for a more transformative change of our system, for a system that doesn't tether your ability to access care to your income or your wealth or your economic status.
I appreciate every single thing you just said. But, however, you know what they say when there's a but or however?
Yeah.
It invalidates everything said before that. But however, that's such a tedious process, such a long process. I'm wondering if we need to, you know, there's this saying in popular culture, when things don't work out diplomatically, people say, well, I guess we need to go to the mattresses, talking about warfare from the mafia point of view. Are we going to need to go to urban gardening and tinctures and herbs and poultices and cloves when we have a toothache? Are we going to, is that what we're being pushed towards? Back towards home medicine? And is that even going to be enough?
Yeah, I love this question because it speaks to what are the options? What are the alternatives? And what are the alternatives that both might not be optimal, might not be ideal, but allow us to retain some agency, some control over who has access to health and to well-being? And I think of this as a both end thing. You're right. The fundamental structural change and even the battles like getting these subsidies back, protecting and defending Medicaid, those are medium to long-term battles, and they're going to be hard. And, you know, I think we have to dig in and prepare for the kind of, you know, to extend your analogy, the kind of trench warfare that is going to have to happen to see forward movement on those fronts. I don't think we should cede that ground or relinquish the hard, tough, long political fights that are necessary to get a system of healthcare that is fundamentally different than the one we have now. So I believe we should continue on that front. But I also think it's really important. I see this when a lot of my work is qualitative, which means I'm talking to hundreds or thousands of people across the country, interviews, surveys, getting a sense of their experiences. And so much of what people talk about is feeling disempowered, feeling like they have to rely on a system that they have no control over that can determine whether they, their children, can be well, can live or die. And they want control. And I think community control, local control, agency over your health and well-being is something that we should return to and care about. You know, I don't think that tinctures are going to replace a functioning healthcare system, but right. I do think that we have community resources and knowledge, right? We have doulas in community. We have doctors and healthcare providers in community. We have community resources and knowledge that we can draw on, and certainly that we can build out. When you think about a time that was really terrible and we wouldn't want to go back to, but the sort of time when healthcare was segregated in the US and Black folks could not go to a local white hospital, it didn't matter if you were dying. You would just die because they were going to take you 2 hours away if that's where you needed to go to get treatment. And a lot of community resources were developed at that time to provide people with the care they needed. It wasn't right. It wasn't ideal, but we found ways of surviving and even fighting to thrive in structures and systems that were designed to harm us. And I think some of that ethos needs to be carried into this moment. And I see it happening in communities, right? This is why the kind of Black doula movement has been growing the way it has. Because Black women, the way we're treated when we're giving birth, nobody wants to deal with that anymore. So what systems can we build of our own in community? Now, of course, those things take money and they take resources and they end up getting integrated into existing systems. There's no way around the problems that exist, but we can be creative and adaptive and find ways of exercising power and agency, even in the midst of these existing systems. And even as we fight to change the systems.
I've been speaking with Jamila Mishner, Associate Professor of Government and Public Policy, Inaugural Director of the Center for Racial Justice and Equitable Futures, also a Senior Associate Dean of Public Engagement at the Brooks School of Public Policy at Cornell University. We've been talking about healthcare in the U.S., the ACA and subsidies being expired, and what we can unfortunately look towards in 2026. Jamila Mishner, thank you so much for being here on Sojourner Truth today.
Thank you for having me today.
Absolutely. That is our show for today. Thank you so much to Jamila Mishner. Thank you so much to Ibrahim Alduma. Thank you to the Sojourner Truth team, Nana Jamfi, Margaret Prescott, our board operator, Ozzy Flamenco, and producer, Gary Scott. And thank you for your continued support. My name is Tanda Sizwe Shimaringa. Remember to find ways to be well in the midst of it all. One love. Thank you.
Support comes from CAP UCLA, presenting Seth Parker Woods, Julia Bullock, and Connor Hanick on January 15th at the Nimoy. The powerhouse musicians unite for an evening that showcases titan composers of lyricism and storytelling from the 20th and 21st centuries. Together, the musicians perform the works of George Walker, Nina Simone, and more. More information and tickets available at cap.ucla.edu and kpfk.org.